KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
It's The Treatment. I am at the Sundance Cinemas with Robert Redford, whose newest film as director is The Company You Keep, the adaptation. Bob, so good to talk to you, finally, in front of the microphone.
Just think, I'm here with Elvis Mitchell.
That's so sad that you have to think about that.
That's a big deal.
That's the saddest deal of all time.
No, it's a good deal.
No, but one of the things I've always wanted to talk to you about is, I remember reading the Playboy interview in 74, when you were out driving and you said you saw Henry Miller crossing at an intersection.
Yeah.
And some kids were like trying to push him along. You just went, take your time, Henry.
That's right. That's right.
And that just made me think about how, as a filmmaker, the things you've done as a director have all been these multi-generational pieces.
Well, I never thought of it that way. I suspect you're right. I think that maybe with in Miller's case, he had a huge impact on me when I was a struggling artist. I started out to be a painter, and I was living in France, and I was just 19 years old, and I read his books, which were outlawed at that time in the States, and it hit me like a ton of bricks. I mean, it really hit me. And then when I read Big Sur and the Oranges of Hieronymus Bosch, I had had a connection with Big Sur myself, and I thought, wow, and things came together. And so I was really a fan of Henry Miller, and I held him in high esteem. And then time goes on, years pass, people lose who they were and some of what they were. But I held him in high esteem. I froze him in time as a very special writer. And I guess I froze him in time as a man of that age. And so when I was crossing the street there, and I had heard vaguely that he had moved down from Big Sur into Pacific Palisades. I just heard that. And when I was pulling out of the driveway to get onto Sunset Boulevard, the traffic was stopped because this old guy was walking a bike across, and he had knickers and tweeds and a cap, and he was slow. And the kids were all just out of school, and they were honking. And I said, hey, move it or milk it, old man, move it. And as I pulled up next to him, I said, that's Henry Miller. Well, I got to make this guy feel better. So I said this dumb thing, take your time, Henry. I don't think you know what was going on. But anyway, to answer your question, I think I've always had respect for all generations. And I think because somebody moves past a certain time of productivity, maybe success, that doesn't mean they're gone. That means there's something still there. And I'm kind of fascinated by what is still there, and you want to respect it. So I think that has something to do with it. And then young people, of course. I think young people who haven't had the experience, they're just coming into the world, and they're at that age where they only look forward. And because they don't have wisdom yet, they can't be philosophical about their lives. They're just charging forward, making a lot of mistakes, doing a lot of wonderful things. But it's very ego-driven. It's, what am I going to do? How can I succeed? But they don't look back because there's not much to look back to. So I got fascinated by that, how young people charge forward. And then as you get older, when you get wisdom, you tend to look back and put some things together, and you see the mistakes you made and why you made them and so forth. So there's a perspective that you don't have when you're young. So I guess I'm fascinated by the behavior of different generations in their different stages.
Because if you go starting with Ordinary People through Milagro Beanfield War, even to Lions for Lambs and Conspirator, and now The Company You Keep, they're all about sort of young people at a kind of a time of forced reassessment.
Yeah. Well, sometimes it's forced on you with tragedy, heartbreak, shock.
As in A Horse Whisperer, I mean, that's the case that happens there,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, exactly. Ordinary People. Ordinary People, for me, was about feelings and behavior. And it was about, I had seen people in my life who had a hard time getting in touch with their feelings, and they were more focused on how things appeared. They were more focused on whether their lawn was cut, whether they were on the A-list of social registers and that kind of thing. I saw those people. I knew those people. And yet I'd never seen a person like that on film. The consequences of not being able to get in touch with your feelings, because it might take you to a place where you wouldn't shine, and how that affected a young boy.
Because it just, it's almost these moments of trauma for these young people in these pieces, and it certainly extends to your daughter and the company you keep. It's really about a period of them either facing this and maturing or just being swept under by all this tragedy.
Yeah, yeah. To me, the film, The Company You Keep, is very much about a father and daughter and what a father will do to gain the confidence and affection of a daughter, particularly when there's something standing in the way, which is his identity that she's not aware of. In this case, a man made mistakes early in his life. There was a child out of wedlock that he and his partner had to separate. And she, that's the Julie Christie part, she had to go and she stayed a radical. I tried to reshape my life, but I had to always live with the fact that I didn't have my true identity. So I get remarried and then I have a daughter and my wife dies in an auto accident. It's just me alone with the daughter. It's my last chance to really have a complete life as a normal human being. But there's something standing in the way, and that's my past. And you know, your past stays with you, whether you like it or not. You know, you can run, but you can't hide.
But I guess I just find this interesting, too, because some of these films you've done as a director are about kind of a seeking of truth and asking questions. I mean, almost every one of these films has been about divining information in some way or another, like ferreting things out.
Yeah, sometimes you have to figure, like in one film I did, 3 Days of the Condor, a man had to think in order to live. He had to figure out what was going on, and it was so bizarre, it was so extreme, what had happened that he walked into. In order to not be a victim, he had to try to figure out what was going on, so it was about a man thinking his way into safety. That appealed to me. I mean, I just like the idea of a man having to think and maybe put the audience in the same spot, because the audience didn't know what was going to happen. They didn't know who was out there. So you like the idea. I do like the idea of involving an audience in the story. You know, I think film is a wonderful broad category, and it can encompass a lot of variety in terms of product. But on my end, I've always been more interested in the humanistic side of cinema. The real life stories about what happens with people and how do they work through tragedies and crises and things like that. So I think the films, the other thing, Elvis, is that as I look back, I didn't know it at the time, but as I look back on a career of, you know, 40 plus years, I realize that thematically, all the films I've made are about America. They're all about America. I haven't made films about other people in other countries. That's fine for some, but that's never been the appeal for me. It's been about stories about the country I grew up in, but the true country I grew up in.
Does it partially come out of the fact that you went away for a while when you were young, you lived in France, you were forced to gain a perspective on the country you didn't have before you left?
Well, it did. I mean, I got a perspective I didn't have before I left. I got a perspective mostly politically, but what did occur to me was we were given a lot of slogans. When I was a kid, it was the end of the Second World War, and there was a lot of slogans. One of the slogans was, it didn't matter whether you won or lost, but how you play the game. That's what you were told was important. I realized it was a lie, that in this country, everything mattered as to whether you won or not. And about that time, I started to get interested on, okay, the America we're given, kind of the propagandic America, everything's wonderful, we're the best, which we are a great country. And I love the country I'm in, but I always felt that there was an America just underneath the America we were given in ads and marketing and things of that sort. And I got focused on what's the real story. There's a real gray zone there, and it's more complicated. We're given a kind of a black and white view of our country, and I'm saying, wait a minute, there's a gray zone that I've kind of lived in. A country that I love makes me look at it harder. What kind of a country is it? And I got drawn into an America that I was seeing, the America that I grew up in, and the complexities of it.
It's The Treatment. I'm talking black and white with Robert Redford. He's white, I'm black.
Oh, you just discovered that, huh?
Well, it's for radio. I want to make sure people know this stuff about me. But as you're talking about this stuff, though, I find myself thinking that so many of these movies, basically all the movies you've done as a filmmaker, the things you've done as a director have been about the possible sacrificing of innocence and of an innocent young person. I mean, their lives in the balance in all these films.
Well, you've hit another chord there, Elvis, the issue of innocence. Because I guess as I look back on my history with the history of my country, I've seen certain events over time where, as I look back on it now, I can say, oh, I can see where our innocence was chipped away at. McCarthy, I think that was the first one where we were in shock that a human being could do this to people, to our freedom. Then you go from McCarthyism, you go to, I think, probably Kennedy's assassination. And the shock, I remember being in a cab in New York. I was in a play, and I was in a cab with two agents that were trying to get me to join their agency. And I heard the radio and announcing that the president had been shot. And the shock, I got out of the cab. I said, no, you, I got to walk. And to take it in. And then that night I had to go on stage. Well, they canceled that night's performance, but I was in a comedy.
Were you doing Barefoot in the Park?
It was Barefoot in the Park. And it was a lot of comedy. And suddenly I realized, oh, my God.
And a comedy about hope, actually, about the future.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm thinking, woohoo, you know, whatever. And you know what I noticed? The laughter changed.
How so?
It changed because it was harsh. It was louder. It was more raw. It was almost like a cry. It was laughter, but it wasn't the kind of laughter that I'd noticed before, and I could feel it. And I realized later, as I thought back on it, oh, I see, that was about a loss of innocence, that there was something kind of edgy and raw about it that said, wait, this laughter is different. Then you had Watergate, the shock that the leader of our country could be guilty of such crimes, and the cost on the people, cost on our political process. Then you had Iran-Contra. You had the years of invading another country that had nothing to do with anything and creating a false premise of weapons of mass destructions that did not exist in that country, and the cost of lives on that endeavor, and the fact that just three or four guys engineered that.
Because for me, the conspirator is kind of about that. It's about that invasion of the Middle East under the Bush years.
Yeah, very much so. There are very strong parallels there. I didn't want to talk about it, you know, but
really,
but
why do you not want to talk?
Well, because then it looks like, what are you, a prophet? You know, what are you going to lecture to us or what have you? But you leave that to the audience. But the fact that I could find that everybody knew about Lincoln. I mean, Lincoln was the most celebrated, the most known about character in history. But nobody knew about Mary Surratt, the first woman to be hung. And it was wrong. It was wrong. She was tried on a military trial instead of a civilian trial. And she was hung. But nobody knew that story because it was buried in the archives. So when Kevin Kline says, as Stanton, the secretary that became the new leader, he says, I want those people buried and forgotten, because he was trying to hold the country together. He was afraid that the South would use that and the whole thing would start all over again. The war would start all over again. So he wanted to stuff things away. And it worked, because when I came across that story, a guy came to me out of the archives. He said, I found this story about this woman, Mary Surratt. I said, now that's the story of innocence. But because of the mood of the country and the mood of the leadership, she was wasted. Everybody knew about Lincoln, but nobody knew about this story that was attached to Lincoln.
And it was also a story about, in so many of these things, you know, basically perceptions, public perceptions are part of these stories that you tell. And the story you offer up about Lincoln is that he's, despite this image, a man who was enormously compromised. And I was reminded of that conversation he had with Horace Greeley about slavery, and Greeley saying, do what's best for the Union. It had nothing to do with being on the right side or the wrong side.
Right. The big picture look, you know, what are we going to do? And of course, you know, you sometimes you waste some things to save other things. And so the expediency, the political need for a character through sheer ego felt that he had the power to hold the country together, and he had to do something like that, to me was fascinating. So again, it goes into that gray zone, you know, where, you know, history tells us one thing, but I think history is really something that is constantly changing. It never sticks. It always changes.
We'll take a break. My guest is Robert Redford. We're talking about a number of things, including his newest film as director and star of The Company You Keep. It's The Treatment. There's more to come.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Have you checked out the KCRW iPad app? It's called The Music Mine. Stream music handpicked by our DJs, watch live performances, and find new music. See why iTunes calls it an essential app for music discovery. Download and learn more at kcrw.com/musicmine.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. You're hearing Ice in the Soda Machines here at the Sundance Cinema, where I'm sitting with Robert Redford. We're talking about any number of things, but his newest film is Director and Star is The Company You Keep. But before we talk a little bit more about that, when I first met you, you don't remember, you probably won't remember this. We end up talking about jazz for a long time.
That's right.
You told me about how you would basically hitchhike from the valet to come into, was it the Parisian Room? Was that where you would see stuff? Or
I was 15 years old, and I was taken by an older woman to a club called The Hague.
That's what it was, yeah.
It was across from the old Ambassador Hotel. She was into jazz, and jazz was just starting in L.A. This was like 1952, maybe, 53?
Yeah, so there's a Jerry Mulligan, those guys, right?
Well, that's when we was in the club, and I went in there, and I thought, what is this? There's Jerry Mulligan on his sax, Chet Baker, Hampton Hawes, Red Mitchell on bass. And the thing that got me, at that time, Les Brown was the band, Sartre Finnegan was the band, Stan Kenton was right on the edge, but these guys... It was another language in music, and I had never heard anything like it, but it just got me. It just got me. Well, then I had a bunch of friends, and I said, hey, you know, I hear that the jazz has moved up to San Francisco. I'd never been there. So I said, let's see if we can cop a car and get up there on the weekend, and I'll show you guys jazz. And they said, what do you know about jazz? And I said, oh, I just heard this quartet. You know. So anyway, we got into this car illegally, drove up. That's the first time I saw Big Sur, because we went off the highway. We went off Highway 101 to get on one because there would be less chance of cops and things, because I was 16. You get to San Francisco, I don't know what I'm doing. We're wandering around looking for what looks like a place of jazz, and we see all these people gathered outside this, looked like a, just a little store. I said, I think this is it. So we all pile in, and it was Ferlinghetti's...
City Lights.
City Lights, yeah. And there was all these bookshelves, and my friends are saying, Redford, you know, what the hell is it? And I said, no, just hang on. And then these guys come out, and they're dressed in very preppy outfits. There's Kenneth Rexroth, Allen Ginsberg, Gary Snyder. I mean, all these incredible guys. And they come out there, and they start spouting this language. And it hit me the way jazz had. It was a new language. It was a new sound. And so jazz and beat poetry kind of came together for me. But jazz, because the beat poetry kind of faded out after a while. It hit a high point and then it faded. But jazz stayed.
Yeah, because one of the things I'd always thought about you as an actor, and I don't think anybody's ever mentioned this before, is I hear something of that kind of sort of reserve of Chet Baker and Miles Davis in the way you work as an actor. You know, the way they were basically... That cool jazz, that period, you never played on top of things. You kind of waited for it.
Right. Well, yeah, I never made that connection, Elvis, but you're right about how I saw jazz. I mean, I that's what appealed to me. It would hang there, and then do something. It wouldn't come at you right away. It would work around it or work up to it, and then suddenly something would explode, and I just found that exciting.
Because it's obvious as a filmmaker and then as an actor, too, you like that kind of thing where people are sort of taken one way and then something explodes and comes out of nowhere in the way that it does in The Company You Keep.
Yeah, you know, one of the other things about this film was that I felt to move the film along, and it had to have a kind of a thriller pace to it. But it had to stop when he comes across these people from his past who haven't seen him for as long as... 30 years, and he has to connect with them. There had to be a pause. You just couldn't race through the whole film. You had to stop periodically to let certain scenes play out. And the tension of silence, because I'm a big believer in the importance of silence, it was almost like muscle tension to try to get to the answer. So you had to let it breathe in the midst of this thriller pace. That, to me, was very exciting, because when those moments came where people look at each other, hadn't seen each other in 30 years, you're not just going to quickly pop off and say, oh, yeah, you're going to take something in. You're going to say, Jesus, look at this guy. I haven't seen him. Well, he looks like doctor, you know, he looks, or no, he's, but it, you have to take time to digest what's happening. And I've always liked that. And I think maybe a lot of films don't want to take that time.
I think
and maybe audiences don't want to take it either. I don't know
if that's the truth or not. My guest, who is sure to be beeped on this show, is Robert Redford. We're talking about his new film.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, you're not sorry. The company you keep is The Treatment. But that thing you're talking about, just sort of waiting in that silence, again, that's the way that Baker would play. He'd come in from the silence, or Miles would in those days, where you just weren't trying to fill up the space.
Or they'd hold a note.
Time. Absolutely.
They'd hold a note.
There's definitely kind of a that sort of California jazz rhythm to me in these things you've done, a lot of these things you've done.
Very much so. I think you're right. I think growing up in California and being exposed to jazz as young as I was, it had a huge impact, because I think jazz in California also, along with surfing, along with beat poetry, jazz seemed to find its place in California. And I remember Hunter Thompson wrote a book I thought was just great about Hell's Angels. It was such a wonderful piece of journalism. And he had a theory that the reason cars were such a big deal in California, motorcycles and cars and the Hell's Angels, was that people had come from east to west and they went as far as they could. They got to California, you couldn't go any further unless you were going to swim. So they went up and down. But they still had the energy and the speed. They wanted the speed, but they would go up and down. So they got into cars, and they'd race their cars, and they'd take their motorcycles back and forth. I was fascinated by that, because I think that applied to me. I always liked movement. I always felt like I had to move. I got very uneasy if I had to stay in one place too long. So the idea of how jazz might play into that is that you hold a note. I remember I telling you about Jerry Mulligan. When he came out, it was alto sax, and he would hold a note and would just hang there. And it seemed like longer than it was possible. And then Chet Baker would accompany that. And then something would move. All that, I think, had an impact on
him. Well, I feel like with this cast, you've got so many great people besides Shia LaBeouf, and you've got Sam Elliott and Julie Christie, as you mentioned, and Susan Sarandon.
Nick Nolte.
Yeah. Terrence Howard. But it feels like it's a bunch of very musical actors coming in and getting solos.
Yeah. And boy, did they deliver, too, because we didn't have much time. As I told you, it was a low budget. And you had to rely on the strength of your actors, the strength of your own instincts, because you didn't have time to mess around. You had to go off of instinct, and you had to work with actors that were instinctive. And I can't tell you the joy I got from working with these actors. They were so generous, and they were so giving. And of course, I said, well, these are my colleagues. You know, these are people. I love these people because I started as an actor, and let's not forget that, you know.
I think you still are an actor, Bob. I don't know how to break this to you. You haven't gotten out of this just yet.
Well, that's what I'm trying to. I think so, too.
But I guess the thing that finally strikes me about this, and the real thread that connects a lot of these movies that you've done as a filmmaker, and even the things that you've starred in, you know, for me, even going back to Downhill Racer, is this sort of agreement these characters make with loneliness. So many of these guys you play before you start directing, you know, in 3 Days the Condor, he's a lonely guy. Sonny in The Electric Horseman, he's a lonely guy. What is it about loneliness that strikes you as being this thing that's worthy of dramatizing on the big screen?
Well, have you ever been in a room full of people and there's been a lot of joie de vivre in the room and there's a lot of high energy and you felt alone? You.
Sure, of course.
Well, I have too. And that has sort of interested me. You know, what is it like to be in a room full of high energy and you feel alone? Why do you feel alone? There's a connection that's missing. And that's sort of interesting. Why? You know, but I have very often, I've been in sports, I've been in a lot of collegiate activity, social parties and so forth, and every now and then I would be struck by how alone I could feel in the midst of all that. And I didn't quite understand it.
Because I'm even thinking, you know, to Quiz Show or Lions for Lambs or Conspirator or Horse Whisperer, these are all movies about loneliness. And these characters have been, these people at the beginning are left alone at the end.
Well, I think that's symbolic in the sense I think you want people to think about why. Charles Van Doren, Quiz Show, was fascinating to me because when I was a young actor in New York, and this was 1959, I was on a quiz show called Play Your Hunch.
With Merv Griffin,
Merv Griffin,
right?
Yeah. And I just had to stand there. you know, and there was a screen in front of me, you know, I was a silhouette, and there were two other guys next to me. We were silhouettes behind three screens, and there was a guy in front. And the question was, which one of these guys behind the screen is this guy's twin brother? And I suddenly realized, what am I doing here? What am I? And what the hell is funny when this? Okay, well, let's find out who it is. My screen goes up, and everybody boos. So my first experience in show business, I got booed for doing nothing but just standing there.
And the movies have been moving ever since. Yeah. But I feel like there's this thing. I mean, at the end, certainly at the end of Quiz Show, he's alone too. I mean, there's
very
people
much.
Are kind of left adrift.
The point that was being made there was that, I mean, the film was about a number of things, actually, about the role of entertainment.
About America, certainly.
Very much about America, because I remember as a kid, you would very often see academic scholars, top people on the cover of Time or Life, or one of those magazines. And then very slowly, I watched, and entertainment was always at the back end of things. And the front end was the hard news and that kind of thing. And entertainment was at the back of the paper, that kind of thing. And I watched it slowly move more and more to the front until finally entertainment was the top dog.
And you were the beginning of you were a big part of that movement, weren't you? That thing was happening around you as you were becoming a star, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's true. And so I felt that. And so I wanted to make, I guess I wanted to comment on that in a film. What is it like? Suddenly you're celebrated way over the top. I mean, in such a extreme way, it's almost completely unreal. It's abnormal. But you embrace it because, boy, does this feel good. And then slowly, either that fades away, or you see that it was fleeting, and then you're left alone.
Well, what I want to ask kind of as a last question is, getting back to this whole thing about innocence and multi-generational stories, the way we started, you've worked so often with these young actors who are basically new to movie-based actors. You go to Ordinary People with Elizabeth McGovern and Tim Hutton, Scarlett Johansson in Horse Whisperer. You got Michael Pena in Lions for Lambs. And there's clearly something about that you like, too, about finding this next wave of actors to work with.
Yeah, that's what Sundance is a lot about. I think that was about giving a chance to new voices and giving them a place to go and develop. Because it's pretty exciting when you see a new voice. So if you could do anything that could help develop those people, you know, give them a chance, to me, that beats money. I mean, money can't replace that kind of reward that you get from that. I love working with new people, and I have in most of the films I've done, there's always someone in there that's new.
You know,
like Britt Marling, for example. Britt Marling is wonderful. She's a natural.
And you have Anna Kendrick in the movie, too.
Anna Kendrick, same, you know. But I think Britt had only done one film, Another Earth, and that was at the festival. But there was something there. There was a truth, an undeniable truth. Same with Anna. And that came out, and I said, okay, let's go. Let's try this.
And Anna was in a film at Sundance, too. She was in Rocket Science.
Yeah, that's right.
Bob, we're out of time. I can't thank you enough for doing this.
Well, my pleasure, Elvis.
I guess it's
Bob. I'm glad you're doing what you're doing.
I'm glad somebody's glad I'm doing it. We're talking about his latest film as director and star of The Company You Keep. Our recording engineer who's sitting across from me, grimacing about all the noise here at the Sundance Cinemas, is Will Bentley. The show is mixed by Melissa Morton. It's edited and produced by Jenny Radelet. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I'm going to go for popcorn. It's The Treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.